Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Steve March Torme may have grown up the son of famous parents, but he's definitely not a Nepo baby. He's performed not just in the U.S., including places like the Hollywood Bowl and Carnegie Hall, but at venues all over the world. Steve has an extensive recording career, as well as producing and singing with other performers like Liza Minnelli. Steve also starred on an Italian television show. He was the lead singer on television's $100,000 Name That Tune. And believe it or not, he's now a Wisconsin resident. Plus, he hosts his own radio shows, and he has a series of upcoming performances all over the area. And joining us is Steve March Torme. I didn't know you were in Wisconsin.
Neither did my wife until last week.
All right. Now, you were born in New York City.
I've been here 18 years now, I think.
Really?
18 or 19 years, yeah. I met my wife in Chicago when I was doing a gig, and she's from Berlin, Wisconsin. And there are more people in this room now than live in Berlin, Wisconsin. And we moved to Los Angeles where I lived, and we were there for a while. And after we had our first child, she said, what do you think about the idea of us living near her parents in Wisconsin? I said, well, for somebody who was born in New York and has lived in LA for over 30 years, I never envisioned living on property with silos. I don't see that. So we did kind of a pros and cons list, and we said, you know what? Why not? We'll be able to maybe buy a house. We'll be closer to her folks because we had a baby, and you know, my brothers and sisters are all over the country, so we had no help. And it worked out. I'm glad I'm here. I've been here, like I said, 18 years and been doing my radio work, gosh, for at least a dozen years now. And my kids are in the school system here, so all good.
Let's talk about you. You said you were born in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And
Manhattan.
Your parents were kind of famous.
Yes. my dad, Mel Torme, that Mel Torme, which, you know, some of you only know from Seinfeld, but he actually was a singer. My folks got divorced when I was two, and my mom remarried Hal March, who was the host of the $64,000 Question Show.
And so, played on just about every imaginable TV show back mm-hmm. in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on with Lucy.
Yeah, so I grew up amongst a lot of showbiz kids.
That's what I was wondering, because yeah. You were sort of the original 90210 kid, weren't you?
I don't know if I was the original, but I came along. Richard Dreyfuss preceded me, but I came along.
Who were some of the kids you hung out with?
The first kid I met when we moved to Los Angeles was Desi Arnaz Jr. He lived up the street, so Lucy lived up the street. And he came to our door, knocked on the door, and I think I was about 12. And I answered the door, and my dad said, well, say hello. And he stuck his hand and goes, I'm Desi. Who are you? I'm Steve, and we've been friends ever since. So it was him, the late Dean Martin Jr., Carrie Fisher. We went to school together, Lorraine Newman. So there were a lot of showbiz kids, a lot of them. And then I started meeting people through them, Jimmy Connors and Nels Van Patten, who was Dick Van Patten's kid. This is kind of a tennis circle. Fortunately for me, I had a dad who was pretty strict. Hal didn't put up with any nonsense. And I had a lot of kids that were on their own, had expensive cars, could do what they wanted. And he said, no, you keep your grades up or you're not doing anything. So I got lucky.
When did you realize your parents were famous?
That's a good question. I think when I saw my stepfather, Hal, on Broadway.
Come Blow Your Horn?
Yeah, very good. At the Brooks Atkinson Theater on Broadway. And I would sit there and tell everybody around me, that's my dad. Yeah, that's my dad. And then, you know, I kind of knew that Mel was famous, especially because of the Christmas song. But I didn't see him that much until we moved out to California from New York. So I would see him once in a while. And then our relationship kind of grew once we moved to California. And I knew he was famous.
When you were a kid, and with the people you mentioned, I mean, people like Desi Arnaz Jr.
And Liza.
As in Minnelli.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And Carrie Fisher, who was Debbie Reynolds' daughter.
Yep.
Yeah, so you were around a lot of musical people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And actors and actresses. I mean, Carrie was obviously an actress. Miguel Ferrer, who was Jose's son, friends with him too. So a lot of show business. Well, that's where they are. I mean, they live in Beverly Hills.
What is that life like, though? When you're growing up with the kids of very famous people,
you
yourself being one.
It becomes kind of normal. That's who's there. It's not like my dad was a plumber or an architect and, oh, look at these show business people. We were all in the same circles. So that's who was there all the time. When I do concerts, I'm constantly asked, what was it like growing up in this musical household with Mel Torme? I said, well, I didn't. I grew up in Hal March's household, and those were all the Borscht Belt comedians. So our dinner parties every weekend were Lucy, Milton Berle, Jack Carter, Buddy Hackett, Jan Murray, Red Buttons. So that's what I grew up around. So it was lots of laughs. It was, you know, just funny people all the time, which is a great way to grow up.
Oh, I can only imagine. Now, you were kind of involved in sports, too, weren't you?
Yes. My first desire was to be a Major League Baseball player. My first love was baseball. And though that was not going to happen, I gravitated towards fast pitch softball. Not the slow pitch beer leagues, but, you know, the kind you see the ladies playing in college. Well, there are men's leagues, too. And I was fortunate enough to make a couple of national teams. I went over to Israel and played in the Maccabiah Games twice.
And won a gold medal.
Twice, yeah. In the sport of fast pitch softball. Yeah, it was a great experience.
And tell me about the Yankees fantasy camp, because you were MVP there.
You're going to probably tell me some stuff I don't know about myself. Yeah, a friend of mine talked me into going to the fantasy camp. I know what the fantasy camps are. It's basically a bunch of guys at night drinking a lot of beer and meeting their heroes, guys that are way past their prime athletically. I really don't want to do that. And my friend talked me into it because he put a guy on the phone. He said, look, someone wants to say hello to you. So this guy gets on the phone. He goes, is this Steve Torme? I said, well, it's Steve March Torme, but yeah, you got the right person. Who's this? He said, this is Tony Kubek. I said, oh, well, nice to talk with you. I mean, he was one of my heroes as a kid because he was the Yankee shortstop and I was a shortstop. So Tony Kubek. And he said, yeah, you ought to come to camp and you'd have a good time. And he talked me into it. So went to camp and I won the MVP award because I could run from home plate to first and not fall down. So that's why I won. That was it.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
Dino, Desi, and Billy, well, they all knew each other before I even moved there. So they had a hit record called I'm a Fool, and they did a bunch of television work and whatnot, and then kind of moved off.
Steve March Torme talks about his friends who were both juniors, as in Dean Martin and Desi Arnaz.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Steve March Torme. When did you get involved in music?
When I was about 12 years old. I had my first band, so to speak. I mean, I was listening to the radio as a kid and singing along with the groups of the day. Right before the Beatles came along, it was Frankie Valli and the Dixie Cups and all the one-hit wonders and, I guess, Ricky Nelson. And then when the Beatles hit, you know, me like a billion other kids said, oh, this is what I want to do. Because it just opened our eyes and our ears. So, yeah, from about the age of 12, 13.
What was the band's name?
The Shades of Sound.
Oh, what'd you play?
Cover tunes.
But I mean, what instrument did you play?
Oh, at that time, just the tambourine and singing. Then I learned how to play guitar and piano. So when Michael and I do shows together, I play both. Yeah, I've been playing guitar and piano for a long time now.
So you mentioned Desi and Dino. They had a group at that time, too.
They did. They did indeed. It was called...
How come they made it and you didn't?
I don't know. Practice? Dino, Desi, and Billy, well, they all knew each other before I even moved there. So they had a hit record called I'm a Fool, and they did a bunch of television work and whatnot, and then kind of moved off. I mean, Desi ended up on his mom's show, Here's Lucy. Poor Dean, who could never go fast enough. Dino, the first time I saw a Lamborghini Miura, which is like one of the supercars, you know, that people go, oh, that car. Dean Jr. had one, and he was tootling around Beverly Hills in that. Then he went to Europe, and he bought a P4 Ferrari, a racing Ferrari, and that wasn't fast enough because you're going to get tickets. So he joined the Air Force Reserve so he could fly jets. That would be fast enough. And unfortunately, on a training mission, he got inverted and the jet went into the mountain and that was the end of Dean Jr. So it was very, very sad. But that was the crowd I hung out with.
You were singing then as, what, in high school and things with your little band? Did you play at school dances and stuff?
Because how else are you going to get girls to look at you? It's changed completely for me. I mean, the whole reason I do this now is literally for the audience. I want them to have a good time and feel like, oh, this guy was welcoming and he did his homework and I felt comfortable listening to him. And back then it was more like, are the girls looking at me? So,
well, that's why most guys join bands,
probably,
don't they?
So.
Yeah, I've heard that from more than one.
Yeah. Figure priorities change.
You did that, but you knew you couldn't make a living. When did you decide to actually become a performer and to hone your craft as a singer?
Probably from about 16 years old on.
Did you take voice lessons or did you just
No, I had a vocal coach for a little while just to learn some tricks. I mean, if you're out on the road and your voice starts to go, there are certain exercises you can do so that you don't get in trouble. And he was good. I had him for a little while, but I'm pretty self-taught on almost everything. And I also can't do anything else. I have no skills whatsoever outside of this. I'm not going to make a living as a tennis player. I play a lot, but no one's going to pay me for it. So I've been a professional, I guess, since about, I don't know, 14, but about 16, 17, I realized this is what I'm going to do for a living. We'll see where it goes.
What was your dad's reaction? And I'm talking about Mel Torme.
Mel?
When you said, hey, Dad, I want to do what you do.
I think he was supportive. I also think, you know, it's not a big secret that he wasn't a big fan of rock music or popular music. I mean, basically after the 40s, he wasn't that interested in what was going on in popular music. And I'm singing songs by, you know, the Doobie Brothers and the Beatles and the Stones. I'm sure he was going, eh, it's cute. And it wasn't until I did my first big band jazz album that he said, okay, now you're finally starting to get it. Now you're singing good music. So he was always supportive. I mean, always. And so was Hal. My dad, Hal, instilled great sense of self-confidence, just saying, I don't care what you do for a living, just try to be as good at it as you can be. I don't care if you're a garbage man, just be good at it. And that's a big deal. You know, that gives you a nice base to start with. So this is all I've done. And the radio gig, I did an album that was recorded mostly in Wisconsin. And my wife said to me, have you heard this radio station, The Avenue? I said, I don't know. We'd been in town maybe a couple of months ago. No, I'm not specifically looking for a station. But she goes, yeah, you should listen to it. Pretty different, pretty eclectic. I mean, they'll play a Billie Holiday tune, and then they'll play, you know, Joni Mitchell. And then they'll play the Stones, and they'll play a local artist. So I listened, and I just finished the album, and I called up the station. I said, hi, my name is Steve March Torme, and I figured, you know, at least they'll know the last name. I've got an album. Can I send it to you? And they said, yeah, send it on. I figured nothing's going to happen. And I got a call back about 4 days later, and they said, yeah, there are like two or three cuts here we play. I said, I'd be thrilled if you took one. Great. So they started playing the songs, and then they called back 2 days later, would you do a station ID for us? Makes sense. Hi, this is Steve March Torme. You're listening to. And then about a week later, the GM called me up and said, yeah, good voice for radio. Can you do radio? I said, well, I hosted a couple of TV shows in L.A. I think I can do radio here in Wisconsin. I think so. So he said, well, we want to give you a slot. I said, well, sounds great, but I want the prime slot. I don't want to be on from 2 to 5 in the morning. I want drive time. I want 3 to 7. He goes, you got it. So started doing that. Then they said, we have an opening in the morning, too. I said, oh, okay. Pay me a little bit more money. I'd love to. So I'm on in the morning. I'm on in the afternoon. And then they offered me a Saturday slot because, to be honest, I'm on more than I want to hear myself. It's like, enough. I don't want to hear that voice anymore. So I've been doing that show, all three shows, for years now.
Do you do those live or do you voice track?
No, we voice track.
And if, for people who don't know what voice tracking is.
Right. Well, and you have to make it sound like it's live.
Yeah.
So,
but you record it in advance.
Yes. At least a day. Have to. And since I will talk about sports, you know, if the Packers have a game on Sunday that hasn't been played yet, I have to say, you know, hey, and how about that Packer game, huh? I can get away with that. Anybody, any opinions on that Packers game? It hasn't been played yet. So I have to kind of fake it and make it sound like it's live. But you're right, that's voice tracking.
I know you're very good at it because I know a lot of people do listen to your show. And that's primarily what, in the Appleton, Green Bay area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say from Door County down to Fond du Lac is pretty strong. But we're streamed, so we have people listening all over the world. I mean, people can listen to avenueradio.com in the Netherlands. So that's pretty nice. We reach a lot of people.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I had a manager at the time who called me and said, I've got an audition for you. It's for a game show. I said, why would I want to be on a game show? And he said, well, how about this, stupid? Hundreds of thousands of people will see you on the show.
Steve March Torme talks about being the male singer on Name That Tune.
Right from the start. You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Steve March Torme. I want to get back to, you mentioned you had hosted a lot of shows in your younger days in Hollywood and when you were in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
You had a big one. And I remember seeing you on it, and that was the $100,000 Name That Tune. You were what? The cute rock singer.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that was interesting. I had a manager at the time who called me and said, I've got an audition for you. I said, well, what? He said, it's for a game show. I said, why would I want to be on a game show? I'm just trying to get a record deal. And he said, well, how about this, stupid? Hundreds of thousands of people will see you on the show. It's television. So I went in, and it was a cold audition. It was a room no bigger than this. There was an executive producer, no guitar, no piano, and I had to stand there and sing Blue Suede Shoes. And one was Elton John's Daniel. And they looked at me and said, yeah, okay. And I got the gig. I replaced Kathy Lee Gifford. She had left the show, I think, a year earlier. So, yes, I became the rock singer.
And you were on for a number of years on that show.
Yeah, we did 3 years of that show. That was fantastic. We shot everything in a summer.
different.
For the entire year. I made friends who are still friends to this day, musicians that I know. And yeah, it was fun. And I learned how to sing two notes at a time, which doesn't help me now, but it did.
I was going to say, because the whole idea of Name That Tune was, I can name that tune in three notes. Yeah.
The Barbra Streisand song, you go, la, 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 who love, la, la, are the luckiest la, la in the world. I can name that tune. I go, yes, people. Yeah, very good. So anyway, it was fun.
All right, another show you did. In Italy, you starred on a television show in Italy?
It was a miniseries for Rai Television. I think it's RAI. I was doing a play in Los Angeles, actually a reading of a play where they were trying to get the play off the ground. And some guys came in to see it and they talked to me afterwards and said, we're doing this miniseries in Italy and it stars our star here, Bonnie Bianco. And I didn't know who this person was. It was some pretty girl. And I went to dinner with them. And they hired me on the spot to go be in this miniseries as the lead. And
wait, did you speak Italian?
No, not a word. Well, Italiano. Basta, basta. I learned some words we can't use on the air in Italian. When I went there, this was in 85, so I was over in Israel playing in those Maccabee games. And I went right from Israel to Italy to go do the miniseries. And I didn't have any of the music yet. And I'm a singer in this. Gee, there's some interesting casting. I got there and they said, oh, so we go into the studio tomorrow to do the songs. I said, what songs? You didn't send me any songs. Oh, it'll be fine. We went the next day, and so I kind of learned the songs, and we did them, and it was an interesting experience.
Was it all in Italian? Or how did they film that? Or were you speaking English, and did they dub your voice?
You know, I don't know. I've never seen the series. I can't get my hands on it. I've tried. It's called Molly O, and I have the album, and I did all my parts in English, and I sang everything in English, and all the dialogue was in English, but I'm going to guess they dubbed it. I would think so. So I don't know who ended up playing
me. You never saw it?
I've never seen it.
Did you want to?
I still want to. I want to see how badly I acted in it. I saw some roughs of it. I had a couple of rough cuts of some of the scenes, but that's it. And to this day, I can't find it. I would like to. So that's our mission, to find Molly O.
And I take it there was no desire to stay in Italy and do other things.
No. It was time to go home.
So you came back, and I think maybe I've got this out of sequence, but you were performing at one point, maybe the Hollywood Bowl, and Quincy Jones saw you and recommended you for a job? How old were you then?
Well, in my 20s, I think, late 20s, or maybe even early 30s, I think. This was a tribute to Henry Mancini. I got asked by a friend of mine, he said, your name come up, would you like to sing in this? I said, yeah, absolutely. So I sang Days of Wine and Roses, and Quincy was in the audience. And I didn't know, I didn't meet him. I got a phone call a few years later. Some guy called me up, same thing like Tony Kubek. Hello, is this Steve Tormé? I said, well, it's the right person, yes. And to whom do I have the pleasure of talking to? He said, this is Leonard Feather. And I knew who Leonard Feather was. He was a huge jazz critic. He wrote for the LA Times. He wrote books on jazz. I mean, a real student. He really knew what he was talking about. I said, well, hi, why are you calling me? He said, well, my daughter Lorraine is working in this project called Swing. And they're looking for a boy singer. I said, okay. Well, how'd you get my name? He said, well, Quincy Jones recommended you. I said, well, if Q recommended me, that's pretty good. And I went in again and auditioned for Richard Perry, very famous record producer, worked with everybody, the Pointer Sisters and Leo Sayer and Barbra Streisand. And he and his partner auditioned me, and I got the gig. So it was myself and Lorraine Feather and a girl named Charlotte Crossley, who was originally in Bette Midler's backup group, the Harlettes. I think that was
Oh, yeah, the Harlettes.
So I became part of it became Full Swing, and we did Brazil, and we toured Japan, and that was really fun. And one day, the girls asked me to leave, you know, because they were getting undressed and dressing. Could you leave the dressing room? And I went out in the hall, I looked in the mirror, I said, this is not for you. You're not supposed to be in a group. And I like both of them, both still friends of mine. But I said, I'm done. And we did the 3 years, and I said, I'm going back out on my own because that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm a solo artist. So I said, yeah, thanks, I appreciate it. And that was that.
What? Tell me about being a solo artist. What is it about that that makes you want to get on stage alone and it's all on your shoulders?
My wife asked me that 2 days ago. She says, I cannot believe you'd do this. Not a chance I would do this. It takes a certain personality. Well, I like that responsibility because it is all yours. And if you fail, you're going to fail in front of everybody and it's going to be really embarrassing. And that can really wreck a career. I mean, it can wreck your psyche if you forget the words, you don't know what you're singing, you're in the wrong place, you just went to the bridge, you weren't supposed to. But I've been doing this for a while and I over-rehearse. Just for that reason, just so I won't embarrass myself. I go over and over and over again lyrics and the music. And I've been a ham since I was 10, so I'm kind of used to this.
Have you ever messed up on stage?
I've missed a couple of words here and there, and my daughters let me know about it. Not a train wreck, but, oh, that wasn't quite right, the wrong word. And they'll say, oh, that was interesting, Dad. I said, hey, what can I tell you? But I've never had a train wreck.
You never had that flop sweat?
No, I don't get that. No. And again, it's because I can't do anything else. It's not like, well, I'm going to try this, and I hope it works. I've been doing it for a while, so let's keep it that way.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
We sang together only about a half dozen times, but it was always great fun. And he was always there for me if I asked him.
Steve March Torme talks about sharing the stage with his famous father, Mel Torme.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Steve March Torme. I have to go back to your dad, Mel Torme. When was the first time you were on stage with your dad?
I think the first time we were together was at a nightclub I was working. And I asked him if he would sing with me. We did Lulu's Back in Town, because that's the song he always wanted to sing with me, because he figured, Stephen can remember this one. And we would trade scat solos. We did some TV together. We did the Dinah Show together. It was sons and daughters of famous people. So it was Mel Tillis' daughter, Pam, who's a country western singer. It was Pearl Bailey's daughter, and Mel and myself, and that was fun. And we did the Mike Douglas Show. So we sang together only about a half dozen times, but it was always great fun. I mean, he was always there for me if I asked him.
Did he ever give you any tips?
Yeah, he said, develop your lower register. And for someone who was listening to, you know, we all grew up on the singers who sang way up here. Michael McDonald, who we saw last night, Daryl Hall, Paul McCartney. That was the style, you know, to how high can you go? And he said, develop your lower register. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be Burl Ives. Why would I do that? But he was right, because there is a sexiness to being able to sing in a lower register, so you're not always having to reach. So it was good advice. I didn't take it at the time, but I have now.
You have an extensive recording career. Have you ever counted how many songs you've actually recorded?
I don't know. A few.
Yeah, more than a few, I think.
A few, and I've written a lot of them, so I'm proud of that.
What do you like better, performing or writing?
Performing. I mean, writing's hard. It just is. I mean, you can be lazy about it and go for the obvious rhyme scheme and the obvious chord change, but to me, that's why even do that? So I try to be interesting in my songwriting. I want the listener to go, oh, I didn't expect that. There's a left turn I wasn't expecting. And that's hard work. It really is to sit down and write songs, because everybody writes songs. You're trying to be different. Performing is easier for me because I've been doing it so long. It's fun.
You mentioned that you like to perform alone. But I know that you also did at least one album with one of your childhood friends, and that was Liza Minnelli,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, I adore. I think she's fabulous. But what was it like working for her?
Well,
working with her, I should say.
I co-produced an album of hers, and I sang on it. And that came out of thin air. Barry Manilow was supposed to produce her last album for Columbia Records. And he was on tour, so he couldn't do it. And she and I knew each other from before, and she was dating Desi at the time. In fact, they were almost engaged, and that would have been a mess. But anyway, she said, I've got this album for Columbia. Honey, how would you feel about producing it? I said, I don't have the skills to produce it, but my producer does. I could co-produce it. So we picked a bunch of tunes that would never be on a Liza Minnelli album, because we had nothing to lose. I mean, she does cabaret-type songs. She does Broadway-type songs, Great American Songbook stuff. And we said, look, they don't care if she's going to sell any albums. It's her last album for Columbia. She's not really a record seller. She's a live performer. We have nothing to lose. Let's pick a bunch of stuff that she would normally do and get her out of her comfort zone and do some stuff that's really cool that she wouldn't pick out.
What were some of the songs?
We worked with a guy named Jim Grady, who was a great musician and a great arranger and writer. So we did some of his songs. The song I sang with her was a Stevie Wonder tune, I Love Every Little Thing About You. We did that as a duet. One of my songs was on the album, the title cut to an album I did called Lucky. We recorded that, and my producer and I looked at each other, and we said, no. And I really wanted to be on there because I would have made money from it. I mean, you've got a song that's published, no matter how much it sells, you're still going to get some money. And it just didn't fit her at all. I said, no. So we took it off. But she did a great job, and I met a bunch of wonderful musicians. And one of the great moments for me, she was doing three different projects at that time. She was doing a live show in LA called The Act. She was on every night. That's hard work, period. She was also shooting New York, New York at 20th Century Fox and doing our album, which obviously had to take third place in her priorities. And I understood that. But she called me while we were doing the album. She goes, honey, do you want to come down to the lot? Yeah, absolutely. I'll leave a pass for you. So I went to 20th Century Fox and went into her trailer. And she said, oh, I'm so glad you're here. And we're shooting this thing today. And I can't wait for you to meet Bobby. I said,
as
okay.
In De Niro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a knock on the door. and it's him. And he walks in and she goes, "Oh, Bobby, I want you to meet Steve. Nice to meet you." He goes, "Hey, I really like your album." It's like, him saying that to me was like, oh my gosh. So that was a great moment, and she was responsible.
You didn't happen to be on the set when she performed New York, New York.
No, no.
Did she ever tell you what she felt? Because she was the first person to record that song.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more identified with Frank Sinatra.
Sure.
It's like, forget the Liza Minnelli version. Did she ever say to you, boy, they went wrong with that one?
No, but it'd be interesting to know what she thought about it. I mean, for the same reason that when people hear the Christmas song, they hear Nat King Cole in their head, not Mel Torme. And Dad recorded it many times and beautiful version, but Nat did the quintessential version of it. And my dad was being managed by the same guy that was managing Nat, a guy named Carlos Gastel. And Dad and Bob Wells finished the song, and they took it to Nat's office. And they played it for him, and it was in the middle of July. And I think they said at the time, "We don't want to hear a song about chestnuts roasting and snowmen. Go, go." And Nat, about an hour later, said, "I want to hear the song again. I like that song." They came back, and he said, "We're recording it." And he now has the quintessential version of the Christmas song. And his is beautiful. I mean, it's a great version.
But, of course, your dad wrote the song.
It'd be interesting to know what Liza felt about Sinatra. Who knows? Who knows? Hers was really good, but his is pretty well known.
Yeah, pretty well known.
Yeah.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
My first solo record is a concept album about a cowboy. Find out through an email from Steve that he wrote a conceptually identical album that I had no idea about 40 years prior, and that cowboy was named Dalton Diamond.
Steve March Torme talks about his most recent project.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Steve March Torme. I'm your host, Libby Collins. So let's talk about what you do now. You mentioned the radio show that you do. I know you perform quite a bit, and one of the shows that you do a lot is called From 1 to 92. Tell us about that.
Well, we do a show called For Kids from 1 to 92, obviously stealing the line from the song. It's a Christmas show, and my friend Michael Murphy is in it with me and a bunch of musicians that we work with in Wisconsin. And it's just a very family-friendly Christmas show. And we try not to be obvious, try not to do all the same songs. We have a couple of, not gimmick songs, but a little bit outside of the box. And I drag my daughters into singing in the show with me, which is shameful, but it works. And they're both great singers. I mean, the younger one's become a very good singer. The one who's in college at Lawrence is an outstanding singer. So I bring them on stage and we do their grandfather's song together. And it's not a dry eye in the house.
Do they want to go into performing?
Oh, there's no question. Yeah, they're both really good.
Do you want them to go into it?
Whatever they want to do is fine with me. And the world's nuts. Good luck to you. Whatever they can do, terrific. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the next week, much less what they're going to do in their careers. But you're not going to know unless you try. And I know neither one of them is going to be IT people. Ruby is extremely intelligent. I mean, scary intelligent. She'll probably end up being a teacher if the performing doesn't work out. Sonny, the one who's 2 years younger, is outstanding on stage. And it's not just the proud dad talking. I'd be honest with you and say, yeah, they have some talent. They're pretty good, but, you know, we'll see. No, they both were the leads in their musicals at a school that's known for it. Appleton North produces kids that are really talented. Sonny came on stage and did Anastasia, played the lead, and you couldn't take your eyes off her. I mean, everybody there, because I looked around, they were like, and her dancing, her singing, she just has the it factor. So we'll see. I hope it works out for them. It's tough business.
You mentioned your friend Michael Murphy, and he happens to be here with us. And he's from Neenah.
I'm from Neenah.
But you also perform. I know you're in New York a lot. You're in Nashville. And you are part of the newest CD by Steve March Torme, and it's called?
It's called Dalton Diamond. You tell the story.
So Steve, back in 84? 1784. Wrote an album with his friend Craig Copeland in Los Angeles. Dare I say you guys did a Bruce Springsteen, Nebraska thing where they recorded everything on a tape deck and
in a bedroom. Yep.
West Coast, Nebraska, we'll call it. And it sat there, and by happenstance, Steve had bounced a few files down where I was able to get a listen of a demo tape from this original tape deck. And how they had originally done the recording was there's one tape where Steve is doing all the lead vocals. There's another tape where Craig is doing all the lead vocals.
Because we co-wrote it, you know, so it's, and he's a good singer.
Very interesting to hear. It's super cool to hear both versions of the song. So I was at the time doing my final year at Lawrence University, and I was studying abroad in London, England. So I was living kind of in the heart of Soho, so basically completely in the arts district there. So I wasn't there that particular semester doing anything music related in school, but I had my guitar with me where I was doing everything on the side. So playing these jazz clubs, playing these blues clubs. So I was out playing in London as many days as I could. And through that, started writing my first solo record, which is a concept album about a cowboy named Indigo Jones. And it was my way of processing loneliness. Well, find out through an email from Steve that he wrote a conceptually identical album that I had no idea about 40 years prior. And that cowboy was named Dalton Diamond. So... Yeah.
Well, I asked Michael, I said, have you heard any of the Dalton Diamond? What are you talking about? I said, yeah. Take a listen. I played him one song. He goes, do you have any more? Said, yeah, a few more. Played him like two more. He said, we have to do the album. Yeah. We have to do it for real. We have to actually make this an album. So that's how it came
out. So I was at the time had finished up. My album was getting, I was completing school. So I was kind of in the throes of finishing recording my record, releasing it, doing all the things. And then at that point, then I had transitioned to get ready to move to Tennessee. And so I had moved to Tennessee in January of 2024. And then I was back up in Wisconsin already in February of 2024 to record this album. And
where did we record this?
We recorded it in, drumroll please.
Yeah.
The living room of my parents' house. So basically, I'm from a very, very musical family. So I have a band with my two brothers. My older brother's a professional performer as well, and he's based in New York. The two of us have been playing and writing everything. He ended up playing on my solo record. He actually contributed background vocals to this record. And so our living room in the front half of our house is essentially just a rehearsal and recording space now. There, you cannot walk anywhere without tripping over a guitar case or
a lot 17, of wires.
17 pianos
mm-hmm.
and a flute that's hanging somewhere. So it's set up to record. And then part of my undergraduate degree is in engineering. So I've just collected instruments, collected microphones, collected preamps, steal things from friends to make it all work. And so we ended up recording the whole record in my living room. And we ended up working together and wrote two more tunes
mm-hmm.
that are really, really interesting and beautiful pieces. A lot of left turns in this album, and I'm very happy with how it turned out. I was very selfishly excited. I have to call back to Steve had mentioned a gentleman that he worked on Lucky and Tropical Nights with, a gentleman named Jim Grady. And Jim is, in my opinion, one of the big unsung heroes of the LA music scene. And it's a shame that we only got the opportunity to hear so much from him, because he was one of the most talented arrangers and has probably the best ear of any musician I've heard that came out of that scene.
Yeah, he got beat down. Yeah. The business I can't do this anymore. It was just too disappointing to him. And this is just, I can't keep banging my head against the wall. And he stopped.
Yeah.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
The first jazz album called Swingin' at the Blue Moon Bar and Grill. I wrote almost all the songs. I think I wrote all the songs on it.
Steve March Torme reveals his greatest accomplishment.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Steve March Torme. It is a hard business. This is, like you said, you've never done anything else. Have you ever reached that point where you thought, I'm done beating my head against the wall?
No, because I've been working. And again, I have no training or skills for anything else. It's not like, all right, well, I'll go do, you know, what I have my degree in. This is it. So I've just kind of stayed with this. I have not made a lot of money, but I've made enough to be able to pay my bills. I've got a wife and two kids. No, that hasn't happened to me yet. And it could. It happens to people all the time. It's that difficult. I mean, there are people out there that are much more talented than I am that are never going to make a dollar. And there are people that aren't as, and they're very wealthy. It's just, it's such a capricious business. It's, you know, there are no rule books. You can't say, well, if I study this book, I'll be successful. No. You go out there and you put yourself out there and see what happens. And for me, I've been lucky. I've had some good successes. So I'm happy with that.
What's the biggest success you think you've ever had in your professional career?
In my professional career?
Yeah, the greatest success. You look back and you say, that was it. That was the big moment.
The two albums. I would say the first jazz album called Swingin' at the Blue Moon Bar and Grill. I wrote almost all the songs. I think I wrote all the songs on it, except for one or two. So that was a success because I hadn't done that before. I'd been mostly doing pop stuff. And this album, the Dalton Diamond album, bringing this to life after 40 years and having it sound the way it does. I mean, this, I don't know who you're a fan of, but this is in the genre of Dan Fogelberg, James Taylor, the Eagles. It's that kind of Southern California pop rock country genre. And Michael's such a good musician and such a good singer that we sing well together. We blend well together. And not everybody does that. We have some friends who are very good singers who can't sing with other people. They don't hear it or they won't blend. They can't bring themselves back. So I would say the two albums. I mean, it wouldn't be Name That Tune. And that was fun. It was cute. I wouldn't call it my success. It was just something I got picked for. But I would say those two albums. And I did another album in Wisconsin called Inside Out that I wrote all the music to. And I like that album a lot. Eight people have heard it, but so what? Such is the nature of the business.
Steve Marchtorme, yeah. You're very talented. You're a lot of fun. Thanks for being here with us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having us. And we're going to sign this CD for you.
We've been talking with Steve Marchtorme. He lives in Wisconsin now, but he grew up with famous parents in Beverly Hills and had famous friends, household names that you know. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Steve, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.